It's honoring Jean England and Bonnie Bobet, who, both of whom recently passed away. And my name is Ben McClinton. I'll be chairing this session. We have two speakers, two presenters, Karen Rosenbaum, who will be presenting a memorial, an essay about Bonnie Bobet, and Catherine England, who will be talking about her father, Jean England. Karen Rosenbaum has degrees in English from the University of Utah, where she was valedictorian, and creative writing from Stanford University. She's published in short fictions and essays in several publications, such as Dialogue, Exponent 2, Sunstone, some small literary journals, newspapers, and anthologies. She lives in Kensington, California, with her husband, who's very near and dear to me, and to both of us, I hope. And she wanted to mention, she does have a church job. She edits the newspaper for the Berkeley Ward. Kensington, you know, is right next to Berkeley. And Catherine England is the oldest of the six children of Jean and Charlotte England. She was born in Hawaii while her parents were on a mission. That's very unusual to be. Her parents were on a mission in Samoa when she was born. And she was raised in Massachusetts, Utah, California, and Minnesota, and now lives in Fullerton here in Southern California. She has a degree which she says is irrelevant because she's a muralist and teaches Shakespeare to children, which I think is admirable. That's wonderful. She's married to Paul Nelson. She's the mother of four wonderful, wonderful children. And she's also, my wife says that she's a writer, so... and she has won prizes, such as the Helen Canlan Stark Prize for writing. And so, the first paper will be given by Karen.
Antidote for Solitude, The Life of Bonnie Bobet. The death of one loved may evoke anguish, regret, confusion, anger, shock, bitterness, despair, relief, gratitude, nostalgia, even joy. The death of Bonnie Bobet evoked in me, both on that Friday morning in September of 2001, and now, months later, wonder. I marvel at the surprises that encompassed her life. That life began in New Orleans on June 19, 1948, shortly after which Bonnie was adopted by an older, childless California couple. Her destiny may have decreed her an only child, but in this, as in so much else, she fought the fates and became, in my mind, a symbol of sisterhood. By the time I met Bonnie in the early 1970s at Berkeley's University Ward, she had already made an extensive family out of friends from the Oakland Public Schools, from dorms and classes and activities at BYU and the University of Utah, and from university communities around the country. In Berkeley, Palo Alto, Los Angeles, Boston, and Washington, exhilarating circles of bright young Mormons flourished, and Bonnie had contacts in most of them. Those college-connected clans were very important to those of us who chafed against the iron rod. We took comfort in like-minded individuals, those who concluded that the best Salt Lake bookstore was Sam Weller's, and the most sympathetic general authority was Hugh B. Brown. We quoted Lowell Bunyan, Jean England, Emma Lou Thane in our Sunday school classes. If they could be Mormons, so could we. We read with enthusiasm Dialogue, Sunstone, Exponent 2. We journeyed to foreign countries. We worked and studied far from Zion. We saw ourselves as the diaspora of the new children of Israel. Outraged at the church's forays into politics, especially the ERA, most of us registered as Democrats. We rejected a celestial kingdom scenario full of undifferentiated Paul and Polly perfects. We wanted to be good, yes, but we wanted perhaps more to be interesting. Those of us who were still single yearned for marriage, usually temple marriage, with fervent partners who had firm testimonies of the complexity of life. It would also help if they volunteered at homeless shelters, read the Sunday Times, and had graduate school projects that would save the whales, or maybe the world. We stayed friends with those who gave up on the church as too repressive, provincial, non-intellectual, or Republican. And nobody stayed friends with more people, people in the church, people halfway in or out of the church, people never in the church at all, than Bonnie. To suggest even the variety of those friendships is dizzying. The gay actor, the concert pianist, the brash Francophile, the blind German major, yuppies, hippies, old ladies, wanderers. When one of us would telephone from across Berkeley or across the country, she would interrupt before we identified ourselves. "Hi, Kevin," she would say, or "Hey, Holly," her voice going up on the "hi" and the "hey." She zeroed in on our concerns. "How's your brother?" she would substitute for brother, the caller's current worry. Troubled child, ambiguous boyfriend, doctoral dissertation, Sunday school class, tyrannical boss, impossible diet. It was easy to talk to Bonnie, to confide in her, because she wanted us to talk. She wanted to listen. She so clearly cared. She also cared intensely about things Mormon, official and unofficial. In her 20s, and not anticipating immediate marriage or mission, she chose to take out her temple endowments. I was astonished. In university wards, one could often serve as the gospel doctrine teacher or the Relief Society president while maintaining a robust unorthodoxy, and Bonnie managed both of those. She and I were both present at that first Sunstone Symposium at the University of Utah campus, but I was content just to sit and listen and absorb the vitality of the event. Bonnie buzzed about. It was she who helped organize some of the Bay Area's early Sunstone or Sunstone-like symposia, a small one at Santa Clara University, a bigger one at the Berkeley Marina. For an orderly person, she was a wizard at keeping track of her many associations and responsibilities. Bonnie had a remarkably high tolerance of chaos. This was evidenced to me by some of her living situations. There was the Albany House on Brighton Street, where the bedrooms were always full, and the refrigerator was usually empty, except for the freezer stuffed with ice cream cartons of Swenson's Swiss orange chip. The unmowed lawn marred the tidy aspect of the neighborhood, and occasionally sighing housemates house sat for me. Sighing neighbors would trot over to with their lawn tools. Bonnie and some of her rowdy housemates house sat for me one spring, and there was so much energy within the walls that I returned home to find that both the front door and the water lines under the front lawn had exploded. Albany proved too tame, so Bonnie found an apartment in Berkeley near the lively old Shattuck Avenue co-op. Many of her close friends were marching or tiptoeing into marriage. Some of those young former housemates, many of her college contemporaries, some even of those old holdouts like me, acknowledging perhaps that her life as a single woman now seemed more likely, she moved to a funky apartment on Dwight Way, a block from Fraternity Row. The streets sang with noisy students. The radiators banged but produced no heat. The tenants organized and sued their landlord. Bonnie replaced roommates with cats that roamed the apartment and curled up on quilts. An old Ronald Reagan movie poster hung from the kitchen wall. When I visited, the apartment always seemed full of people, the kitchen sink full of plates. Bonnie's culinary masterpiece was a mean reine de saba, a chocolate cake that contained no flour. It was during this period that Bonnie opted for single motherhood and gave birth in September of 1988 to Jane Elizabeth, a baby with her own exquisite skin and hair. There was quite a crowd in the birthing room, two friends at the head of the bed chanting encouragement, two at the foot. Three of those close friends were women with firsthand experience in giving birth. The fourth was someone who had never expected to share in such an adventure, Bonnie's longtime gay friend, Kevin. During the first two decades of our friendship, Bonnie was almost always running somewhere, but she invariably ran late. I adjusted to her tardy arrival at dinners and other social events. What shocked me was her missed deadlines for graduate papers. I had been in graduate school 14 years earlier, and it would never have occurred to me that the teacher might accept a late paper. It never occurred to Bonnie to turn a paper in on time. She also found it quite normal to take leaves of absence from her doctoral work, sometimes to do advertising for a Bay Area bank, sometimes to freelance, and, I suspected, to work on relationships in Utah. But then Bonnie regarded her Berkeley professors as peers, as companions, not as emperors and gods, as I had been taught. In fact, one reason Bonnie was able to embrace such an enormous circle of friends was that she was intimidated by no one. She was very close to a number of Mormon bishops, from younger and sensitive to older and crusty. Her very best bishop friend was Oakland First Ward's Richard Paul Freeman. Dick counseled her and helped her stay a Mormon during the birth of Jane. He presided over Jane's most extraordinary naming and blessing ceremony, held at the Paul Freeman's home, during which two or three dozen friends, Mormons, ex-Mormons, non-Mormons, men and women, bestowed their own blessings on and wishes for the baby. When the leukemia first appeared in 1992, Bonnie underwent a successful autologous bone marrow transplant. Dick and his spirited wife Lindy turned part of their upstairs into a private convalescent home. Each time the leukemia returned, Dick gave Bonnie blessings. And at her memorial service, which she herself planned during one of the few times she acknowledged aloud that she might not beat the cancer this time, Dick gave the spiritual message. In all things a student, Bonnie was open to learning from widely diverse books and teachers. She applied her scholarly techniques to become an expert on acute myelogenous leukemia, and she efficiently managed her own health care. She researched alternative medicines and was willing to try Chinese herbs and meditation. Her stays in sterile rooms lasted weeks each time, and she knew every nurse and nurse's aide and understood and appreciated what each one did for her. She was inordinately fond of Dr. Gary, and in the last period of her illness, she told him that if he didn't get her through it one more time, she would turn his name into the Democratic Party as a potential deep pockets. He was not a Democrat. He had got her through the illness in 1992, but Bonnie attributed this miracle cure to the prayers and positive thinking of her wide family of friends. Her religious chums fasted and got down on their knees. Her agnostic pals wished on stars and hoped for healing vibrations. At the time, her widowed mother was feeble, vague, and devastated. Her daughter was a toddler. Bonnie had bravely sent her away to Utah to live with her best friend. "I can't be checking out of here," she said. "The very old and the very young are dependent on me." Advised that it might increase her chances, she opted to be part of a study employing a particularly aggressive treatment of the bone marrow. A year later, the treatment was declared a failure. Only one patient of the 70 or so in the program had survived, and that was Bonnie. Dr. Gary didn't use the term in remission. He used the term cured. During the 8 years that she was cancer-free, Bonnie no longer ran. Much of her energy had been depleted in the initial battle with the disease. But she managed to maintain and amplify her existing relationships and even add to her cadre close new friends. She was able to comfort and eventually bury her mother. She and Jane spent time with cousins. She had already contacted her birth mother, a Canadian citizen, and had developed a close association with her and with her husband and her children. After she and Jane moved to Albany, tameness now seeming an asset, they began attending the Berkeley ward. And she made more friends, among others the Sandbergs, warm and witty Betts and Mark, twins Ben and Jonathan, Jane's age, and little Michael. "We're kind of raising our kids together," Bonnie said. She also felt close to the ward's senior citizenesses, some of whom she knew, and some of whom knew what it was like to be a single parent. And she delighted in some of the younger student families as well. During this time, Bonnie joined a writing group and started working again on some of her graduate school projects. When she showed her writing to her advisor, the advisor, by now a good friend, told her that she had done enough work for a PhD in American Studies. To celebrate, Bonnie and Jane took the Sandbergs out to dinner. The dissertation, with the esoteric title, Domestic Constructions, Mary Wilkins Freeman and the Anxious Locale, occupied one chair. Most of her efforts in those years were devoted to Jane. Even in the Bay Area and the accepting climate of the Berkeley ward, it wasn't easy to raise a child without a father. There were the primary and young women's lessons on temple marriage and traditional families. Once, when Bonnie wasn't diligent in getting to church, Jane complained, "Mom, we might as well be Jack Mormons." Bonnie was chastised, and though they rarely attended all three meetings, in times of good health they usually made it for the last two. During one Sunday school lesson, a woman shocked the teacher in class with her vilification of Jews. I was not present, but was told of the stunned silence. Bonnie later reported to me that she was defending my heritage when she raised her hand and with controlled anger said she could not let such remarks go unanswered. The woman would later scream at Bonnie that she and Jane didn't belong in the ward, but many ward members sought Bonnie out to tell her how grateful they were that she had dared to do what they had been too cowardly or startled to do. I saw no tears shed when the anti-Semitic woman moved her family's membership records into the ward in whose boundaries they actually lived. Many tears were shed when Bonnie's leukemia returned in the fall of 2000 and again after an 11-month remission following chemotherapy in the late summer of 2001. It is not easy to ask for and to accept help, but Bonnie managed this with grace and gratitude. With the recurrences of the disease, she needed a great deal of help, care and transportation for her and Jane, household tasks, food, but mostly companionship and contact. What loyalty she elicited from members of her network. During her Berkeley hospital stays, or when she was allowed to convalesce at home, she was almost never alone at night. In the hospital, a woman friend bunked on the chair bed in the sterilized room. Devoted Marilyn Thompson spent so much time in the oncology unit that the staff thought she deserved a paycheck. At times, the person on the night shift would be the aide to the nurse's aide. If Bonnie's temperature crept up, it might be necessary to pack her in ice. If she got the Riker shakes, it might be necessary to call for Demerol. During bad nights, the companion got little sleep. In the first month or so back home, women from the ward, young mothers, middle-aged matrons, older widows, took turns camping out at the apartment to make sure that Bonnie didn't spike a fever or need anything in the night. During her last hospital stay, many of the older women in the ward regularly sent her cards and notes. One wrote her a postcard every single day. "Don't let them give up on me," Bonnie said. The great ladies of the Berkeley ward never gave up. Bald but round-faced, sturdy, clear-eyed, Bonnie never looked to me like a dying woman, even the morning before she died. She did seem more solemn, though. While I was sitting near the foot of the bed, the substitute doctor, a thick woman dressed like a 60s hippie, breezed in and announced the number of Bonnie's white cells had jumped. Although the words sounded hopeful, I saw Bonnie nod, and I sensed that they both knew that this was a very bad sign. The last time this had happened, it signified that the chemotherapy had not worked. I had driven to the hospital that morning after driving Bonnie's very closest friend, Utah Susan Anderson, to the airport. Susan, Bonnie's soulmate from BYU, and the person who had probably shared more experiences with her than anyone else, had taken one of her many leaves of absence from her own family and had been staying in Bonnie's apartment with Jane. I worried that Jane didn't have her apartment key, and I suggested to Bonnie that I take her key. That way, when I picked Jane up from school, we could be sure she could get into the apartment to get her flute and to pack her things. After her flute lesson, she would be spending the night at the Sandbergs home. "We'll trust Jane," Bonnie said. "She always remembers her key." That afternoon, Jane did not have her key, so we drove up to the hospital to get Bonnie's. "It was good I forgot it," Jane said. "Mother was having the shakes, and I was able to help her." Shortly after we left, Bette Sandberg arrived at the hospital. She noted that Bonnie looked as weak as she'd ever seen her, but she didn't see how she could spend the night since she had Jane and her own sons to care for. At that moment, Holly Larson walked in, took one look, and announced she was staying. "She was very tired, very sick, and had trouble talking," Holly wrote later. "But as she turned over in bed, turning from the interior wall to the large window that looked out on the Berkeley Hills, she exclaimed, 'Holly, look at the sun.' I looked. There at the top of the hills, which were enshrouded in a gray mist, was a brilliant path of sunshine illuminating the clouds. It was lovely, and Bonnie was able to give me," Holly writes, "this gifted beauty of life in one of the saddest and most difficult moments of my life, and surely of hers." Very early the next morning, the nurses sent Holly home to Alameda, and they transferred Bonnie to intensive care. Barely inside her front door, Holly picked up the ringing phone and rushed back to the hospital. She was there when Betts and Jane arrived. "Oh, Jane," she said, throwing her arms around her, "your mom is gone." Since that September 21st, the vast number of Bonnie's brothers and sisters had been trying to absorb that sentence. Many of us gathered at the Sandbergs home that day to stroke Jane's hair, to make necessary plans, to comfort one another. "I've lost my best friend," Holly wailed when I hugged her. But she had dozens of best friends. We want to believe, of course, that we haven't lost her, that she isn't gone. At first, we could speak and think of nothing else. The sacrament meeting talks in the Berkeley ward the Sunday after her death focused on the value of community and of what that had meant to Bonnie. From across the country, we gathered to the memories for the eulogy at her memorial service and for a book we gave to Jane. As those of us in the Bay Area boxed up her dishes, her clothes, her books, her treasures, we recalled her vitality and tried to determine her wishes. What should be stored in Utah for Jane? What should be donated to charity? What should be given to whom? I went through sacks and sacks of letters and cards from people who loved Bonnie. I hated to consign any of them to the recycling barrels, but how could we keep them all? They would require another storage locker. Bonnie's big, big family web is already unraveling. It was Bonnie that knit us together. During her illness, Andy, one of the neighbors in the noisy Dwight Way apartment building, sent out regular email updates on her condition. Some of us hadn't met in person until she died, and we aren't likely to meet each other regularly again. Others of us do often talk, we contemplate Jane, who is living with the Andersons in Salt Lake City, and how keenly conscious we are of Bonnie's absence. Her will nominated Susan and David Anderson as Jane's guardians, but she also specified a kind of parenting committee, not a viable alternative, it has turned out, but an affirmation of Bonnie's faith in the abilities and goodwill of her many friends. We do try to stay connected. Holly is currently buying up a big block of Giants tickets for June 19th. That way, instead of sagging morosely around our various abodes, Bonnie's friends can cheer for Bonnie's favorite team on what would have been her 54th birthday. Ah, Bonnie, we would have loved to have grown old with her. She would have been, as her neighbor, sister, and friend Deborah has said, a sensational old lady, draped in vivid colors, treating us to her healthy laughs and her acute observations of life. Sometimes when I'm writing, as I am at this moment, I think, I'd like to run this by Bonnie. She was surer than I am about what happens to the spirit after death, so I don't picture her hovering about. But I suspect that if that is possible, that's what she's doing, keeping track of all of us, as well as catching up on what's happening to those who got there, wherever there is, first. I believe we, all her hand-picked siblings, will be able to remember her features and her voice and her nature as long as we can remember anything in this life. And in that way, we will keep her alive and around as best we can. In that way, we will minister to our own solitude. I just wanted to say, too, that I'm really pleased to share this time with Catherine England, whom I used to babysit many, many, many years ago, and how much I love the England family.
I'm already beclimbed. Parts of my talk I delivered at a memorial service that was given to my father last September. And afterwards, we have a slideshow that we put together. I wish you hadn't gone first. There should be a box up here. For many of us, when a person dies, the memory of their life becomes like the ending of a song from the 70s. It simply seems to play the last lines over and over till it fades away to silence. I guess that can be good. The pain lessens, we turn our attention to the living around us, and we go on. But just as in life, Eugene England could never leave us with the usual, the expected, or the mundane. For several months, I couldn't even remember the melody of his life for the blaring... For several months, I couldn't even remember the melody of his life for the blaring last measure of his death. But finally, I began to understand that even in his death, his dying, his suffering, he continued to teach us what he had his entire life. He was the personification of love, patience, and joy, capital J joy. He was, as ever, large and in charge. Large and in charge was our favorite catchphrase for Daddy, and I'll tell you how we got it later on. He has always been larger than life since the day he was born. He was born on a small Idaho farm to parents hungry for a child, yet convinced they would not have one of their own. He began this life with expectations put on only a few. My grandfather, a God-fearing as well as a God-expecting man, took my young father out into the fields of their dry farm on an early Sunday morning and dedicated my father to God. It seems a burden I would have resented. I think Daddy took it quite seriously, and everything he did revolved around living the teachings of Christ. He writes about it in his poem, The Kinsman. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but in the poem, he's gone with his father to the corner of a wheat field, and where the heads of grain have just starting to form and turn. And my grandfather says a prayer as they stand in the field. Quote, he stops, and my grandfather says, "Thou art the prince that holds my heart and gives my body the power to make. The fruit is thine, this wheat, this boy. Protect the yield that we may live." He was a delightful, mischievous boy who grew into a charismatic and popular teenager. He met my mother, Charlotte, after his mother saw her perform at a violin recital. They dated and had their first kiss, he claims, at the altar of the Salt Lake Temple. We had serious doubts as to the validity of this story, as my mother always ends that account with an incredulous, "Oh, Jean." Shortly after their wedding, the Korean War ended, and they were able to serve a mission together in Samoa. I believe this experience of going from homogeneous small-town Salt Lake to the exotic, primitive, and simple life of the Pacific Islands, where they had their first exposure to poverty, racism, and selfless service, dedicated them to a life spent in acceptance, generosity, and service. They started a family, a magazine, and a career during the volatile 60s, and things got larger and larger from there. One of my earliest memories of my father was when I was about 5. We were visiting his parents in Salt Lake City, and my siblings and I were trying to sleep in the dark basement bedrooms, but I could hear loud voices through the ceiling above me. They were raised voices and opinionated. Adults in intense discussion can sound scary to a child. From the voice intonations and decibel levels, I was sure everybody was angry with one another. Shortly, I heard laughter, and I was comforted and fell asleep. In the morning, there seemed to be no anger between my parents and grandparents. It was my first experience with something that would be common in our family, passionate discussion without harboring bad feelings. When we moved to Palo Alto, my siblings and I would sit on the stairs listening to my parents' weekly study group. Again, I heard animated voices, shared ideas, testimonies, insights, and opinions. As we grew, we children became part of this powerful dialogue. Sunday dinners became litmus tests for potential boyfriends or girlfriends. Some of our guests felt empowered by the discussions and joined in. Others ran away. We married the ones that stayed. To this day, a heated, open, and spirited discussion is our favorite family exercise. Childhood with Daddy was unique. Yes, we went to Disneyland once. Living in Palo Alto in the 60s, however, provided ample opportunities for even more amazing field trips on which Daddy taught us the importance of love, compassion, and human kindness. We visited museums, were pulled from school to participate in peace marches and moratoriums. My baptism gift was not the Monkees album I had asked for, but a trip to San Francisco to see Nureyev and the ballet. We visited national parks and made countless trips across the hot Nevada desert to Utah for general conference and to visit family. We never stayed in motels. Dad would drive late into the night and then pull into a small town such as Winnemucca, where we would sleep in the town park until the sprinklers came on early in the morning or the police woke us up with flashlights, or we would sleep at a rest stop. One time we woke up to find ourselves in a cemetery. Daddy embraced what the 60s offered. Like many others of his generation, he felt liberated and challenged by the decade. I remember Daddy pulling me out of school once to drive to San Francisco to take food to the American Indians who were occupying Alcatraz in a protest of broken treaties. Daddy loved to listen to the Beatles, Joan Baez, and Simon and Garfunkel. He also loved Nat King Cole, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and opera. Our father taught us all to fish. We spent endless sunburn hours on a boat, bait fishing in Strawberry Reservoir. Later, Daddy embraced the higher art of fly fishing. A few years ago, he began to teach each of his grandchildren how to fly fish by taking them to a magic fishing spot called Monte Cristo. Fishing was an intimate activity we all shared with him. I can still hear Daddy instructing me, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock. Favorite bedtime stories Daddy told us were about the gallant Sir Gawain who beheads the Green Knight, or the heroic Beowulf who fearlessly chops off the monster Grendel's arms. Thanks to Daddy, we had great nightmares. We heard story versions of Macbeth and Hamlet, as well as stories of growing up on a farm in Idaho and running the combine with Grandpa. Even while he worked on his doctorate, served in the university ward bishopric, and started Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, Daddy found time for us. My sister Becky remembers that she never felt Daddy wasn't there for us or with us. He was big to us. He always had the answer, challenged us with important questions, had a story, or was ready to delight us with an adventure. Jane remembers getting strength from his wisdom, grace, and humor, and patience. It was always urgent to him that we learn to be aware of others, and his teaching tactics might seem extreme compared to today's parenting. One night for family home evening, he called us in, and we found 5 pieces of licorice on the table. Of course, the first of us to arrive greedily devoured the treat, leaving the 6th child to arrive to nothing. It was a shaming experience and somewhat manipulative, but it definitely left me with a knee-jerk awareness of how my actions affect everyone in my community. His view of the world has inspired us as we've grown up to take on the world as adults. Four of six of his children serve missions. We have chosen lifestyles and jobs that embrace the humanities we were raised to love. We have become artists, editors, writers, community and global activists, and teachers. We have married good people in the temple, and even as adults, we experience Daddy's larger than life and let him lead us on adventure after adventure. We knew if we stuck with Dad, something extraordinary was bound to happen. From witnessing the assassination attempt on Pope John's life in 81, to meeting the Polish ambassador when he thanked Daddy for his Food for Poland campaign, to sneaking vodka to the box office manager of the Bolshoi in Moscow as thanks for getting us tickets to a sold-out performance, to walking backwards into the exit of a sold-out Picasso exhibit in Venice, to finagling the best seats to the best theaters in London, Dad always seemed to be front and center to what was happening on stage or in the world. I began to appreciate how large and in charge Daddy was when we moved back to Utah. I was at the Foothills Shopping Mall on 21st East. Mom and I met some people selling calendars with fabulous black and white photos of the early days of the church on each month. They were trying to raise money for a new publication called Sunstone. We chatted for a while and offered to take some of the magazines to sell to help out. When we were writing a check to pay for them and they saw the name England on the check, the man got very excited. He not only knew who my dad was, but kept saying amazing things about him. He loved my father. That's when my father started to really get big to me. We moved to Provo. He worked at BYU, started Food for Poland, got Professor of the Year, and was even alluded to by a famous apostle in a 14-stake fireside. Now, isn't that special? He really knew how to live full on, and he didn't hold back. He was a full participant. He loved his life. I'm convinced he woke up every morning and thought, I'm the luckiest man alive, and he went out and did amazing and extraordinary things that most of us only dream about. Some of us don't even dare to dream of a life as full as his was. There was nothing he set out to do that he didn't do, and he never complained. He never said, I'm too tired, I'm frustrated, or I can't do that. He just did it all and loved every minute of it. Living a powerful life has its reward, but there are also drawbacks. Often there were unkind or untrue rumors or stories spread about Daddy. Once we even got a brick thrown through our front window. But the payoffs for Daddy and those that he influenced were incredible. Daddy changed lives. That's what I heard most when people first heard he was my father. Your father changed my life. What an honor, what a compliment to change a life. Something he did in a lecture or a conversation, a Sunday school class, or an essay helped them to understand God or their religion in a way that inspired them, moved them to action. A woman in my parents' ward told me the other day about a lesson that my father had taught 10 years ago. She volunteered the next day to make and deliver 25 lunches every Monday to homeless people. Some even said he had saved their lives. I know few people who live their religion more honestly than Daddy did. Not only was he committed to following the rules of his religion, and he testified profoundly of its doctrines, but he really lived a life of forgiveness, love, peace, and absolute integrity. My most valuable lessons on the pure love of Christ came not from his lectures and writings, but from watching Daddy interact with people every day. He truly loved everybody, even people who didn't like him, and people responded in kind. During his illness, we received letters from people of different faiths and cultures who expressed a love and intimacy that might be considered exceptional between most people of differing ideologies. We have dozens of letters from parents whose children were transformed by a semester of study abroad with our father, as well as people who were profoundly influenced by his years as a gospel doctrine teacher or bishop. Daddy was a peacemaker. If he ever had a conflict with somebody, his first reaction was always to look immediately at himself to see what might be adjusted to bring about a meeting of the minds. He didn't spend his life proving he was right. He simply started a dialogue and learned from whomever he was conversing with. Even when Daddy was forced to leave BYU after 21 years of dedicated, faithful teaching, he chose not to be bitter. Several of us closest to my father, however, resented those who we felt had shoved him out or given him grief while there. We badmouthed those we saw as the perpetrators. He tolerated our gripe sessions, but never joined in them or added fuel to the fire. Some of us even believed that our father must have held some hidden resentment, and we blamed last year's mysterious depression on his suppressed anger. How wrong we were. Finally, we realized that our dad had truly forgiven those who we felt had wronged him. He chose to accept their rejection of him rather than fight it. Inspired by Lowell Bunyan's example, when he had been dismissed from the University of Utah's Institute of Religion, Daddy moved on with his life and created a new space for himself at Utah Valley State College, where he could once again make a difference. In fact, this is where our large and in charge phrase was coined. After leaving BYU, he was able to come back and be involved in what he loved. He was speaking at a Sunstone for the first time in many years, and my brother-in-law turned to Daddy, who was truly once and again in a place he loved with people he adored, and said, "Gene, once and again, you're large and in charge." Free from the constraints of BYU, he went to UVSC and started the study abroad program. Then he started a Mormon cultural studies program with a National Endowment of the Arts grant, and with others won an award for developing a curriculum that dealing with ethics and society. Not bad for a retired man. Daddy loved the humanities. I think that literature was how God he believed that literature was how God best spoke to his children. Daddy intertwined his love of the gospel with his love of literature. He quoted Melville and Shakespeare in his gospel doctrine class and cited the Book of Mormon in his literature class. To him, it was all the Word of God. Now, I think it is important to do what is innately a child's right and responsibility, to point out a parent's shortcomings. There were many misconceptions about Daddy that we children feel should be set straight. For example, many think that Eugene England was an academic, when in reality, he was a sports junkie. He would call from a plane in flight on his way to London to ask my cousin Loretta to tape the Wimbledon finals so he wouldn't miss them. He would record San Francisco 49er games and make his poor son-in-laws watch them over and over with him. He'd get just as excited at every play as if it was the first time he'd seen it. Some people think he was an intelligent man, even a genius. Here's some moments indelibly recorded in the Book of Life, which we will now include as evidence to the contrary. Quote, "Hey, we can wire this house ourselves. Look, I bought a book that can teach us everything." To a new son-in-law, "Of course we can make it over Squaw Peak in a couple of hours. We'll be back in time for dinner." My husband and brother-in-laws fell for that only once. Those of us left at the cabin laughed. Quote, "Yeah, it's muddy, but I think we can get the moving van through it anyway." Quote, "It's 6 a.m., time for scripture study." And here's a zinger. Quote, "Bishops of single wards should be empowered to match members of the ward together in what would be good couples for marriage." Colorblindness and a belief in minimal spending would have led him to dress mostly a la Hugh Nibley or Lowell Benyon. But he was very patient and humble and allowed his daughter to dress him in electric blue shirts and bell-bottom pants at our whim. But worst of all were his insights on men, and the men that Daddy thought his daughter should be interested in dating, and I'll spare you those grisly details. Much of the credit for Daddy's seemingly amazing ability to get things done really belongs to those who responded to his repeated requests, dare we say, badgering. We felt we'd feel great about coming through on some essential assignment, only to find out that we'd really just been part of his redundancy plan. He had entrusted several of us with the same task, only to eventually do the job himself. By far, the biggest misconception about Daddy was that he was at odds or critical of the church. In many ways, our family was about as orthodox as they come. We faithfully had family home evening every Monday, scripture study every morning, long family prayers on our knees, morning and evening. We never shopped or traveled on Sunday, and we never heard Daddy swear or even raise his voice in anger. He spent his life serving the church and the people in it. Never, never in my entire life, even in intimate discussion, did I ever hear him say a single unkind, critical, or derogatory remark about any church leader or any person ever. Many people looked up to my father, but he never looked down on anyone. Daddy taught, loved, learned, and enjoyed life. When he got sick about a year and a half ago, he began to be depressed. We were all alarmed. Daddy had never been depressed before. He slept a lot. He lost weight. He sought help everywhere he could to fight this strange feeling. He became more and more intimate in his conversations and teaching. He was a little raw. It was confusing to those of us who knew and loved him. He wasn't as funny, nor did he take the same joy in things as before. He was not large and in charge. It was scary. When our father collapsed last February, neurosurgeons removed the tumor and cysts from his brain, and we hoped the cancer was gone, since the doctors could find no primary source for it. Daddy then got better, then worse, then better. We hoped, and Mom tried everything. Jennifer and Jane moved home to help care for him. Jody and Mark and Rebecca came often to help. Daddy was massaged, washed, blessed, fed, read to, sung to, touched, caressed, and loved as much as a human being can possibly be loved. He made friends with the nurses and physical therapists, remembered their names, and always thanked him for their care. He was gracious, kind, and uncomplaining. He turned to Mom for everything, and as always in our lives, we learned from him. It was an honor to serve him. As his body shrunk and withered, he remained with the most beautiful face. Even with his thick hair gone, he was beautiful, and as large and in charge as ever. The last week of his life was almost surreal. We orbited through the house silently, picking up food that had been left by concerned neighbors and friends. I will never forget Mary Bradford coming and crawling up on the bed, covering my father's unresponsive face with kisses and crying, "Oh, my eternal brother." Daddy's good friend, Doug Thayer, visited daily. Flowers and notes were left on the doorstep as if by elves. As my father lost his ability to speak, Jane read almost all of Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety to him. Unwilling to leave his presence, we slept on the floor in chairs in the room. Finally, beyond tears, and unable to speak, we were silent. Daddy was buried last. It was a service I didn't expect to attend for several more decades, as my grandfather was 93 when he died, but this was not to be. My father allowed that every person was of an extraordinary nature, full of possibilities, and that through love and gentle persuasion, these possibilities could be realized in all of us. When someone leaves us, we feel the unsettling uncertainty of when or if we will ever be together again. I am content not knowing where my father is now. It doesn't matter. For wherever he is, he's large and in charge and having the time of his life.
Through the wind of my soul. Where I end up, well, I think only God really knows. I sat on the setting sun, but never. I never wanted water once. Never. I listen to my words, but they fall far below. I let my music take me where my heart wants to go. I swam on a dead hill's lake, but never. I never make the same mistake. Never. When I get old and losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me Valentine's birthday greetings, bottle of wine? If I've been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? And if you say the word, I could stay with you. I could be handy mending a fuse when your life is gone. You could make the sweater by the fireside. Sunday morning, go for a ride. Doing a garden, digging a weed, who could ask for more? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Every summer we can rent a cottage in the Isle of Wight, if it's not too dear. We shall spread and save grandchildren under me. Dear John and Dave, send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Indicate precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer, fill in a form, mine forevermore. Oh, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Thank you. There is still a light to shine on me.